This week, we welcome Colby Dias, Director of Product Management from AppGate, to discuss zero trust access to, from, and within the cloud. In the leadership and communication section, no, we're not discussing Log4j, 2021 recaps or lessons learned, or 2022 New Year's resolutions or predictions. Business Security Weekly starts now.
This is Security Weekly, for security professionals by security professionals. Broadcasting live from G-Unit Studios in Rhode Island, it's the show where we explore the business of security to improve the security of business. Your trusted source for actionable insights on leadership, communication, and innovation. Get ready for Business Security Weekly. Let's face it, cyber attackers have the advantage. ExtraHop is on a mission to help you take it back. Regain the upper hand with security that can't be undermined, outsmarted, or compromised. When you don't have to choose between protecting your business and moving it forward, that's security uncompromised. See how it works in the full product demo, free online at securityweekly.com/ExtraHop. We're proud to announce CISO Stories, a new podcast series in partnership with Cybersecurity Collaborative and Cyber Reason. CISO Stories features the candid perspectives and experiences of frontline senior security executives and dives deep into timely security topics. CISO Stories is hosted by Todd Fitzgerald, VP of Cybersecurity Strategy at Cybersecurity Collaborative, and Sam Curry, Chief Product and Security Officer at Cyber Reason. Listen weekly as they speak with extraordinary CISOs by visiting securityweekly.com/CSP.
Welcome to Business Security Weekly. This is episode number 245, recorded January 10th, 2022. Happy New Year, everyone. I am your host, Matt Alderman, here in Colorado. Joining me remotely for our first podcast of the year, first, Mr. Jason Albuquerque.
Welcome. I love it. Happy New Year, everybody. I love that intro. You know, it's basically, listen, the cool kids, we don't talk about prediction resolutions. We just get stuff done, right? I love it. That was a great intro.
Exactly.
And I cannot believe. Oh, go ahead, Matt.
I was going to say, plus, December was just loaded with Log4j news. So
right? And I can't believe that we are talking about playoff football. And I think your Broncos just lost their coach. Is that correct?
I hope so. I don't track them because they're so bad. Like, if you don't fire him, there's something definitely wrong.
I want to say that's hot on the wire. I don't know. I think I saw something on the news feed this morning, but we'll see.
All right. We'll talk football second segment. Also joining for this first podcast of the year, Mr. Ben Carr. Welcome, Ben.
Hey, Matt. Great to be back again after the new year. It's been a long time. Was going through a bit of withdrawals there, not talking to you guys on a Monday. So, yeah, really excited to be speaking today. First rule of predictions is you don't talk about predictions, right?
Right. And you're going to get me twice this week, so I'm sorry. I'll get to that later, too. Don't miss any of your favorite Security Weekly content. Visit securityweekly.com/subscribe to subscribe to any of our podcast feeds and have all new episodes downloaded right to your phone. You can also join our mailing list, Discord server, and follow us on social media and our streaming platforms. Also, join us January 20th to learn how to build your own security lab at home. Yes, Paul and the gang are going to show you how to build your own lab. Then join us on February 16th to learn about validation techniques within applications. Finally, join us on March 2nd to learn 5 things you can do to catch more bad guys. Don't forget to check out our library of on-demand webcasts and technical trainings at securityweekly.com/on-demand. This segment is sponsored by AppGate. To learn more, please visit securityweekly.com/AppGate. Colby Dias has 20 years of experience in leading development, delivery, and marketing of enterprise software solutions. As Director of Product Management at AppGate, he works with clients around the globe to accelerate their move to zero trust networks. Colby, welcome to Business Security Weekly.
Hey, guys. Thanks. Glad to be here. And Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. You are first interview of the year. So we're going to talk zero trust network access to, from, and within the cloud. So I like to start with, what's the problem? Like, what's the challenge with cloud assets that requires us to think about zero trust network access for those assets?
Oh, wow. That's a really good starter question. So we don't have 4.5 hours to get through it. So maybe I can summarize some of the challenges that we've seen, that I've seen personally working with clients, is as they move into the cloud environment, it's a whole new set of technology. Maybe they started with thinking like the cloud, that it's just another data center. I got compute and storage and networking. And then very quickly you find out, oh, there's a whole bunch of other stuff going on in cloud. And the way that you manage it, the way you secure it, provision it, everything, it's all real different. So you got that kind of world where things are kind of new in cloud and you're trying to apply older style, the sort of network and identity security that you've used on-prem. You try to apply that to the cloud. You find where it starts to break down. That's all a whole problem unto itself. But now, you know, a lot of organizations really thinking about how do they move to zero trust, where you've got this concept of instead of perimeters, like you would in a traditional world, think about a perimeterless environment. Think about how all the applications, all your resources could theoretically be exposed to everywhere. So now how do you protect the resources that could be potentially exposed to everyone? How do you protect them so that they're not going to be touched by anybody except and only by the folks who need to have access to them? Using the devices they're supposed to be using at the times they're supposed to be using it, right? It can get really complicated to try and tackle that, especially if you take like an older approach. So I see a lot of organizations kind of moving to the cloud and looking to adopt ZTA, almost as if they're two different activities, but they can be applied together at the same time. So you can secure these cloud environments and be assured that even though they're running in the cloud, only the folks who are supposed to have access to them will have access to them. That's a kind of a quick summary. I don't know if that can't cover all of it.
It is quick. So let's get into some of the specifics. Because the first thing I think about, okay, I have to spin up my infrastructure. So I need to log into my Amazon cloud environment. I need to create an EC2 instance, right? Or some sort of instance. That was kind of like cloud 1.0, right? You'd log in, you provision a server, and then you'd have to give access to that server. Well, I just use, you know, like RDP or SSH, or I'd use something that already existed on the box. What's wrong with that?
That sounds absolutely awful. Thankfully, a lot of folks aren't actually doing that. What we see is that, you know, they're spinning up the resources. Maybe it's an EC2 instance, or maybe it's just RDS. They're spinning up databases or messaging systems, queuing systems. And of course, you don't want to just allow anybody to have access to it, spin up a server, make it available to the whole world. No, but you are still going to be using kind of a traditional network approach. You think about virtual private clouds, VPCs, right? You're setting up your IP tables, you're setting up your security groups, or kind of like a newfangled firewall system. You're setting up IAM policies. There are still a lot of these sort of traditional ways of securing an environment that you do in the cloud, or at least they feel a lot like the traditional a security approach. But that sort of approach gets people into trouble because, as you pointed out, hey, maybe I'm going to run an SSH server and I'm going to go with a security group that has any allow, and now everybody on the planet can have access to it. Obviously, that's some pretty crazy stuff. So you don't want to do that. But you also want to avoid trying to have to learn all the security nuances from AWS, all of them from Azure, GCP, from all your other cloud providers. You need some mechanism to say, I want to grant or deny access to the resources, whether they're in the cloud or they're on-prem, they're my private cloud, wherever they are. You need something that's going to be standard that can apply no matter where you're at. I think that's another reason why you look at zero trust, because the model like zero trust doesn't have to say it's very specific to this cloud provider. It's an approach that you can apply no matter where your resources are running.
So right? Colby, I'm interested, you know, when you talk about this, it leads me to the question of, you know, where do you start and how do you declutter what's been spread out there as kind of peanut butter by a lot of different vendors, right? We've talked about it on the show before. Everybody kind of gravitates towards these gravitational wells in the industry, right? And zero trust is the gravitational well of today, that everybody wants to label everything as zero trust. And it just gets to this confusing, I guess, landscape of tools that everybody's trying to pitch as a solution. Yet at the same time, I think that there's a lot of you know, security teams and CISOs out there that are coming from a more traditional background, that even though cloud's been around for some while, they're still trying to grapple with, how do I get a good overview of the landscape and where I actually need to start to give me a good security posture moving forward in this zero trust world? And what actually is the thing I should start with from a zero trust architectural standpoint?
Yeah, a lot of vendors, especially the traditional vendors, come out and want to ZTA wash their solutions, yeah, right? And say, hey, of course we got ZTA, and it's probably just more refined firewall rules. I've seen that quite a bit. And I think it sounds good in a marketing sense, but practically it doesn't work really well. I mean, consider that zero trust has a very different approach. You don't think about like perimeters, you know, protecting the environment. You don't think about, I've got a trusted network that if I logged in on the company laptop and I'm in the company network, that that should automatically be trusted. Now, I mean, with ZTA, you should have a whole mechanism whereby your ZTA approach is verifying who the user is. They're verifying the device that they're on. They're verifying the security posture of the device, perhaps even the security posture of the user's behavior. And you don't trust the network. In fact, you want to verify what network is being used. Is it someone accessing from their home, from a cafe style network, or from the local, or perhaps a branch office? Like, all these factors have to come into play before you want to grant anyone access to a resource, whether that's an application, it's a file, it's a database. So you need to be able to do that kind of analysis. And you, really importantly, you have to do that all the time. It's not just a one and done. I've seen a lot of beginning approaches where folks just want to rely on, my identity manager said that that's a valid user and they're on the local network, so that'll all be good. Or they use transit gateways to protect assets in the cloud. That's a real common and definitely a valid approach to take, to start with transit gateways. But then transit gateways, you're just kind of trusting that the traffic going over the transit gateway is what's going to protect you. When in fact, you really need the ZTA approach, where you're analyzing the access and the requests constantly. And I haven't seen transit gateways that were able to do that.
It's really continuous validation, right? It's looking at all those factors kind of all the time to make sure that something hasn't changed where you no longer have that trust.
Hey, it could be that I logged in and my identity provider verified, and I want to get access to a resource, and I'm on a trusted network, a known network that where we just did the security analysis, and yep, it all seems fine. And then all of a sudden, my endpoint protection system is running analysis and finds out, I'm going to say log4j because it's been so topical.
You know,
there's some sort of vulnerability on my system. At that point, you want to lock that access. Perhaps actually more realistically, what's happened is, you know, even the user who's, you've done the verification of who they are, the verification of their system, you've done all these security checks, you grant them access. What happens when the asset that they're trying to access, like an application, it's scanned and they find a vulnerability in that, like the log4j issue? Well, at that point, you might want to restrict access to that service. So we often think about zero trust as checking to make sure that the user can have access, but it's the user on this device, on this networking, accessing that resource. So even the resource itself, or the asset, the target asset, is going to be continually analyzed to make sure that it's secure. And if it has any sort of issue, you might want to lock down the access or require the user to, you know, fill in an MFA, fill in an OTP, right? You might do step-up authentication just to verify that they should have access, or to help restrict who should have access to a potentially compromised environment.
Now, Kobe, just I want you to demystify something for me, because I have a lot of conversations with CIOs, and I try to guide them in the right direction when it's starting the process of looking at zero trust as a philosophy and a framework and a best practice. And sometimes you get the pushback, you know, I don't know if our organization is mature enough to be able to start down that path. And from my perspective, no action is still an action, right? And if they're not doing anything, that's bad, right? That's not good for their overall security posture. They need to start making some progress towards zero trust. And they'll come back and say, listen, you know, I have cloud resources and assets. I have software as a service applications. I have infrastructure as a service in, say, AWS or Azure. I have legacy on-prem workloads that still require me to have a hybrid approach when it comes to my identity management. I have to have on-prem identity that syncs up to cloud identity management. I have third-party vendors who need access to these legacy applications. And they look at that as a barrier to entry. But there is no barrier to entry to start Zero Trust, is there?
Only your will to start. That's probably the only barrier, right? You have to decide that as a business, it's important to you to secure your assets. And you have to make it at a business level, right? Some executive sponsorship is going to be needed to really push that forward, I think. And the organizations that are able to start to make those transitions, what I've seen that's really common among them is they've got the executive sponsorship. They've identified folks who are going to help lead an initiative to implement Zero Trust. Very often, that's done within like a cloud center of excellence. Since we're in the context of like shifting to cloud or hybrid cloud, very often I've seen the cloud center of excellence help in being the home for that project. Where you say, I will identify a handful of applications or assets that we want to protect. We want to do a trial of this ZTA approach. So finding the right folks who can do this, like in the security, cloud security, cloud center of excellence. Wow, new year, brain fog. So that's really important. Identifying the project's really important. And then making sure that in that project team, you've got your network folks, your identity folks, your cloud folks, right? And an application member. That's even like the ideal right there. If you can get those kinds of four groups together to collectively understand what ZTA is, right, and have collectively identified the applications to try and run test projects, you can very quickly, very easily put together a ZTA approach in a small space. And once you achieve some success with that, and it can happen like in the matter of days, it can happen in weeks, depends on how the scope of your project, but it can happen very quickly. But a quick win allows you to then demonstrate to the organization that it's possible, it's non-disruptive to the end users, because nobody wants to slow down the business. Why should they? Right. And that you end up you build a blueprint for how you will secure additional applications and assets. Whether they're in the cloud or on-prem or hybrid, it doesn't matter. The small team can start and build that out for you right away. And then you can take those successes to additional projects. One thing I will say is you definitely need to consider adopting automation here, because the scale of rolling these things out, I'm confident that once you show that you're successful with some initial projects with ZTA, the business will recognize it needs to do this everywhere. And so you're going to want to invest in automation to make that happen as well.
That's great. And the moral of the story is there's no barrier to entry aside from will, motivation, and the want to execute. So thank you for that.
Look, a lot of what you need for ZTA, you have a lot of that in-house in terms of identifying security risks and all that. So there's a lot of leverage that you can get from the existing technology. There's no one solution that does everything for you. So don't think that even purchasing something has to be the barrier to entry. You can begin even today with something pretty simple.
Yeah, when Jason was here a couple months ago, Garbus, we were talking about kind of the remote access VPN use case as kind of one of those places to start, Colby. Then I could see shifting to access to like cloud assets as a logical add-on, because now I need to give those people I just gave access to my environment now access to those cloud environments. Is that a logical way to think about how you would structure how you get started?
Those seem like really nice platforms, projects to get started with. Definitely like a VPN replacement makes a lot of sense. A lot of organizations, especially due to pandemic, had to deal with the fact that you've got a remote or a wildly hybrid organization now. And so you recognize that your VPN can't handle the scale, but more importantly, it can't actually protect the individual assets. So if you can have a project that's replacing the VPN, that's a great start. That is a natural first step before you go in and replace something like a the gateway into the cloud. So we see these gateways into cloud environments are very much like large scale VPN solutions. And a lot of organizations say that they struggle with having to push everything through these transit gateways in order to get into the cloud environment, and that they don't really scale for what they need. So yes, I would agree. You start with like a VPN project and move into like a the gateway replacement. That would make a lot of sense. But even within a small environment, without having to replace a whole bunch, you could get started, you know, with some part of ZTA. Right? We certainly talk about that in podcasts and webinars that we do at AppGate as well. You know, just to share more stories that we have with customers who've made those transitions.
Now, the other thing you said, and I fully agree, is there's no one solution for zero trust architectures, because it requires, you know, pillars around identity, network, apps, you know, data, devices, et cetera. But when you're thinking about it from this particular point of view, which is a VPN replacement that also removes your transient gateways to get into the cloud, what are the things you should be looking at in those solutions so that it can continue to scale and integrate to solve other use cases? Are there specific things that people should think about in their evaluation criteria that would be important in a zero trust network access solution, for example?
Yeah, I'm for sure you're looking for something that is dialed in for zero trust access. It is actually a unique thing, even though the term's been around for a handful of years. So you want a mechanism, you want a solution that is able to take security data from multiple sources. It needs to be able to integrate with the kind of investments that you've already made in security, so we can understand the security posture of the people, the devices, the assets. It definitely has to be able to do that. It really needs to be able to do these on-the-fly policy assessments. So constantly analyzing all these data feeds to ensure that the right folks have the right access through the right mechanisms to the right resources. So that has to be continuously done, not just the first time you log in. It should be done all the time so that you can immediately take back access when something's gone awry or somebody's at risk. I think one thing that's really, really important, if you think about the ZTA definition from NIST or how they describe one of the great capabilities, the single packet authorization, right? This is the concept of you can cloak all your resources. So people can't attack it if they can't see it. They don't even know it exists. And we believe like single packet authorization is a hugely important capability that you want to consider in your ZTA solution. It really does allow you to kind of put anything out on the net and feel secure that it's not going to get touched because nobody can see it except those folks who've been approved through the policy assessment.
Right. I think that's a very interesting point, right? Because I didn't even know that was part of the definition. So see, I learned something new today, like single packet authorization. Like that way your assets aren't even available for others to, you know, to search or find because it's all done through, right? Yeah.
You can't ping them. You can't see them, right? Anybody that tried to make a call to it, you know, that would just get dropped. So as an attacker, you can't attack the system, right? That's perfect mechanism.
Yes. Ben, Jason, any additional questions for Colby while we have him here today?
Yeah, one question I did have, and you know, I'm one of those security leaders who typically likes to understand what they're going to be getting into before they start, you know, cranking any dials and putting any controls in place. Are there tools and mechanisms where you can actually start doing, and this is maybe to get ahead of the game for folks who want to go down this path, passive application observation or getting telemetry on the network that could prepare them for going down the zero trust architecture initiative, you know, something that can get them up to speed as to what's happening today so they can start preparing for the future and really start building out that architecture internally.
Well, you know, there are a lot of tools out there that can tell you like what's happening on the network. But that doesn't necessarily tell you exactly who is accessing mm-hmm. exactly what. You might get like a device-to-device connections. And plus, you don't really know the intent. And oftentimes, you can't really map who had that access back to the identity provider, right? If we're going to go ZTA, we know that identity and network information are tuple that you need to have. So I really can't speak to other tools that are out there that might try to do that. I'm unaware of anything that does it like mm-hmm. that. I know like in our environment using AppGate, you can spin that up and have people access the environment, and you can learn who's accessing what. And then from that rule, from what we've observed, you can say, I want to codify that as a policy.
Yeah.
I often hear about that as a desired starting state, because mm-hmm. we're working with organizations that are wildly complex, rapidly mm-hmm. changing all the time. It's really hard sometimes to get started. So one of the ways I would recommend it, at least if you're working with AppGate, is you'd spin up an environment, a small environment, and let it observe what's going on. And then you can build the policies from there. It's a pretty good start. Ultimately, of course, you want the system to learn over time. So I guess one of the other attributes I should say is that that when you're looking to evaluate something, is it should definitely have an API set that you could plug into your environment. So as new mm-hmm. applications and all that come online, you can automatically define policies that protect that application. Just like if you make changes to your identity services, right? That should mm-hmm. automatically get fed into the service that'll provide ZTA solutions. Yeah. So APIs.
So that's great. By going with AppGate, you actually get those tools natively within your platform to be able to do that level of observation, so you can make intelligent decisions on the controls you want to put in place.
You said that way better than I did. Thanks. But that's exactly the case. All right, you want to make it simple. So let AppGate observe it, and then you can codify that as a policy. And then you can rest assured that policy is constantly enforced. And you don't even have to define the rules about how often we're checking. It's always checking that for you. It's always going to check awesome. To see whether or not somebody should have access, not just the first time they logged in.
That's great. See, Jason summed it up for us all on this first episode of the year. Colby, thank you so much for joining us on Business Security Weekly.
Hey, thanks for having me. It's good to speak with you guys.
To learn more about Zero Trust Network Access or how to protect your cloud assets, please visit securityweekly.com/AppGate. We're going to take a quick break and then cover the leadership and communications articles for this week.
People require access from anywhere to resources everywhere, but legacy security is ill-equipped for today's hybrid organization. AppGate STP delivers Zero Trust Network Access for hybrid workforces and workloads, empowering trusted users with secure, frictionless connections to only what they need. Make your attack surface invisible and reduce time to provision by 91% with AppGate STP, a leader in the 2021 Forrester ZTNA New Wave. Learn more at securityweekly.com/AppGate. Cyber risk and compliance automation is finally here. Legacy GRC systems cannot support the powerful, real-time automation and oversight that organizations require to take risks that matter to succeed. CyberSync continuous control automation ingests data from the IT GRC stack to update controls against regulatory requirements and risks in real time, delivering insights and visibility. See how members of the Fortune 500 are saving millions annually by visiting securityweekly.com/CyberSync. Every 11 seconds, there's a new ransomware attack. Oil pipelines, universities, corporations, all paying millions of dollars. Barracuda says, don't pay the ransom. Before a ransomware attack occurs, train your teams to recognize an attack and use anti-phishing technology. Protect your applications, and they can't get onto your network. Simple backup and restore solutions quickly recover your data without paying the ransom. Build your ransomware protection plan now by visiting securityweekly.com/Barracuda. That's securityweekly.com/Barracuda.
Welcome back to Business Security Weekly. I am your host, Matt Alderman, joined by Jason Albuquerque and Ben Carr. And Milo's in my lap right now, so just so you know, my cat decided to join us for the segment. Do you have a specific guest or topic that you want us to cover on one of the shows? Submit your suggestions for guests by visiting securityweekly.com/guests and completing the form. We review suggestions monthly and we'll reach out to you once reviewed. Also, we had an absolute blast putting together this year's Security Weekly Unlock virtual event. Actually, it was last year's. All presentations are now available on demand for your viewing pleasure. Please visit securityweekly.com/unlocked to register and watch now. All right, gentlemen, first set of articles for the year. No Log4j, no 21 like lessons learned, no 22 predictions. I don't do that, as you guys know.
No resolutions, none of those resolutions. No resolutions,
none of that, none of that, right? However, we got to catch up on a couple things around football. So,
yes.
First of all, speed matters, Michigan. When you decide to play an SEC yes. team, you cannot just decide to power the football like you do in the Big Ten. Lesson number one, right. Which is why the Buckeyes have recruited the way they have the last few years. Yes, they lost the big game, but they show up when it comes to the SEC occasionally. Okay. And then pro football, you guys are great. The between what the Cowboys are doing and what the Patriots are doing, awesome. The Browns and the Denver Broncos have to go through rebuild seasons yet again. That'll be like six, yeah, 7,
you know,
8 years
in a row. I was going to ask Milo how dad feels about those Broncos. That was going to be my question for Milo.
Oh, gosh. Just crazy. Crazy, crazy. All right. Now we can get to articles. So there we go. First article. This is almost a summary of 2021. This is a think tank discussion reframing the CISO boardroom relations, which we covered a lot of these articles last year. So you could almost classify this as a summary. It wasn't intended to be that at all, but I'm going through this and I'm like, but where are the tips? Like what is the reframing? And you don't get to anything of real substance, I don't think, until you get to like the last paragraph of the article, which is ultimately the responsibility for security decisions is vested in the CEO, while it is the CISO's
that's
role
to influence.
That's
the one line I pulled out, Matt.
That's it. Like this
I
whole
pulled
article.
One line out. We need to convince the CEOs that they are accountable. That's what I pulled out.
That's exactly right. Yeah. So does that mean that's how we're reframing the board discussion, is we just have to make it clear to the CEO that it's his job?
I guess we got to offer some clarity, because ultimately it is, right? I mean, at the end of the day, it's the responsibility of the board. It's the responsibility of the CEO. And I love the comment, right? I love that one comment that I pulled out, is ultimately the responsibility for security decisions is vested in the CEO, while the CISO role is to influence and inform. Dead on.
Right. Exactly right.
Yeah. I think the overall issue here, though, is a lot of CEOs don't see it that way, right? It's funny because it's their number one risk in many cases. They'll admit that it's their number one risk, but it's not treated with that level of importance. So, right. the framing was interesting in the article.
Yeah, it was. And that's why I was like, that's interesting, but okay. You could have wrote that paragraph and called it a day. Like all the other words didn't do anything. So then we move to the next article, why CISOs shouldn't report to the CIO.
To the CIO, right. And I think that last article is going to support it, Matt, because here's the thing. The CEO will never realize they're accountable and have skin in the game if there's a filter of the CIO. If there's a filter there, it's never going to get to that point where the CEO
or any filter really, right? I mean, that's kind of the issue. I mean, it gets down to that. Yeah, you know, what is the level of importance you're dealing with this issue at the CEO level? And I think it's almost got to be a direct report. I mean, there can be arguments made. You know, it shouldn't be the CIO, so it's got to be somebody else. And I think depending upon the temperament, the manner of the CEO, like what they're going to gravitate towards. But ultimately, like, given the level of importance, it's something they should be taking as a direct level, direct report importance level.
100% agreed.
Exactly. And even to the point where I brought this next article in, because this one makes the case that the CIO should actually report to the CISO. So think about this for a second, right? We remove the filter of the CIO, move the CISO into a more direct relationship with the C-suite, the CEO, the board, et cetera. Does the CIO become his peer, or does the CIO report to the CISO?
I'm seeing this more and more. I mean, I've seen a couple companies, I made a recent transition, and that's part of the discussions that I'd had with some companies around, potentially the CIO reporting up under the CISO. I had a conversation with a really seasoned CISO this weekend that's thinking about a move, and the move he's thinking about, that's potentially what they're looking at, is having the CIO report to the CISO. Yes. I mean, I think it makes a lot of sense.
I 100% agree. And, you know, I went through this in my past job, right? Where I was the CISO of the organization, and we were able to transform our security program to a degree where the CEO came to talk to me to taking over IT holistically, right? So the success of security and the oversight that security brought to the table, the trust that we brought in front of our customers ultimately put us in a position to take over the entirety of the IT responsibility for the organization. So that's where the CIO and CISO came to bear. And I would not have that CISO title pulled. It was part of the stipulation with the CEO that, listen, I'm always going to be the CISO of this organization, even though I'm taking on IT responsibilities overall, because that's the most important piece of this, to make sure that we're doing everything with security in mind, and it's built into the DNA of this organization.
And we've talked about this before on here, right? Where the CISO is becoming more of this business line executive. In order to be successful, you have to talk in more of the native language of the business. And I think that's the outcome here, right? As that CISO becomes more of that business line executive, then they're paired with the ability to understand risk and really make those critical risk-based decisions. And that natively falls into where the CIO is going to be asked to handle things as well, right? I mean, thinking about things, okay, well, what's the risk if we don't do this business initiative versus we do? It's the same decision. It's just, you know, a different area of responsibility. So I think this is a native extension and evolution of where things go.
Agreed. And Jake, you know, we've talked about it on the show before. What type of CISO are you, right? Because there's certain CISO personalities, I guess you could say, because we talked about the transformational CISO, the post-breach CISO, the tactical CISO. I think it's a natural transition for the likes of a transformational CISO, you know, coupled with, the customer-facing evangelist, because you can go out there and promote to the rest of the business and promote to customer base. So I think there's a certain skill set that you need to be able to take on that level of responsibility and own the entirety of the IT responsibilities as well. But if you're, you know, if you're that transformational CISO, that's right in your wheelhouse, right? It's definitely something that you should be thinking about.
I think on that same line, if you think about people who are maybe, you know, the steady state guy, right, or the post-breach guy, I mean, that may naturally bring you into kind of like a deputy CISO role, right? Where you're kind of forming more of the core functions of the CISO, and, you know, the overall CISO is handling more of that strategic and risk advisory level.
Yeah.
I like how JJ framed this at the end of the article. He says, the case can be made that the emergence of the CISO role and its separation from IT operations is a primary reason for many of today's cybersecurity failures. And I think back when I was at Qualys and Tenable and other places, right, where the security team would identify the vulnerability and then they'd have to throw the report over the wall to the IT operations guys to go patch it, and they don't patch it and they wonder why the systems get hacked. Like, he makes a very valid case here that by separating the two, we actually created more issues around securing our IT infrastructure than we did in fixing it. Therefore, if the CIO reported to the CISO and one of the priorities of the CIO was to address security vulnerabilities as part of the IT operational side, we'd be in better shape. And I think that's a very interesting case to be told.
It is 100% hashtag truth, Matt. Because one of the first things when I was able to take the CIO role and really run with it, being a security-focused CIO and CISO, was to integrate the entirety of the IT department into the security best practices, right? Yeah. So in essence, what we had was a security practitioner in every single IT role. If you were a network admin, you were integrated with security and doing security work, right? If you were a server admin, you were doing security work. I mean, at the end of the day, everybody became a cybersecurity professional within the IT department, not just the security team. They were one in the same, embedded.
And I think the native direction that goes, the journey that takes us on, if you extend that, is things like, you know, cloud and dev and where those are outside the realm of the traditional CIO. And I think the CIO has been somewhat isolated. Looking at the CISO sitting at an overarching level, you can start bringing that stuff back under them and have truly, like, not an information technology, but a technology structure that actually supports a secure development, secure infrastructure, mm-hmm. secure network. It's overall security is embedded in everything. To your point, it's that native security champions program that's rolled out throughout the entire technology stack.
Right. And it gets back to the name of the role, the chief information security officer, right? Because there's information around all these other areas that have to be integrated mm-hmm. in together, right? I mean, that's the yep. point of it.
100%.
Yep. Next article. Let's see. 6 ways to reduce cyber risks in the C-suite. Notice the theme, a little C-suite-ish today. That's because I wasn't covering the 4 million other articles on predictions and resolutions for the year. But I thought it was interesting to think about, to consciously think about reducing risks in the C-suite, because I don't think we think about it in how do you reduce risks across my C-suite environment and address this holistically. We think of it mm-hmm. as maybe the CEO and the board and the CISO, but where's the rest of the C-suite engaged in the conversation? This kind of highlights some of the things that I think need to be discussed and thought about internally in organizations.
Yeah, I mean, the one thing I would add in here, and there's one I would probably adjust a little bit as well, but you know, it talks about discussing cybersecurity in the board meeting, so you can have that conversation across, you know, the business units. It talks about evaluating business risks and cyber threats. What it doesn't talk about is embedding security into the other business units, right? Mm-hmm. And I've said it before. We have, you know, I've had liaisons in business units where, you know, and Ben's talking about the business security officer, right? The BISO, just to have security embedded within the department. So that way it's a conversation during all of the business unit meetings. Security is part of their DNA and what they're talking about to run the business and run that business unit. I would have added that to this. And the other one I would adjust is, you know, number 4, which says increase cybersecurity budgets. Well, you can't do that with a hatchet. What I would say is right size or make sure you're spending in the right areas, right? Before you start increasing cybersecurity budget, because maybe you're not spending in the right areas. Maybe, right. you know, there could be silos between business units. It's
a lot of spend on the wrong stuff, right? I mean, yeah, right. It's funny when you walk into an org and you see what's actually going on and what's been spent. And you know, it's not necessarily they don't have the budget. It's that it's misaligned. I think a lot of companies do underspend percentage-wise, but yeah, the misalignment's a big problem. For me,
because if we walk in the door, Ben, if we walk in the door and say, give me more money, we're going to get the stink eye.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right? I mean, that's the first thing that's going to happen is the stink eye. Well, why? Tell me why. Yeah. Tell me what you need. Tell me what's not right. Tell me what we need to invest in. And if you don't have your A game when you're coming to the table, you know, and there's misalignment across the business units and how they're spending in the cybersecurity budget, you know, you're spending, you know, good money over bad, and it's not going to add value to the organization.
Yeah, the thing that called out for me again, we wrapped it up kind of that last line here, like a third of CSOs and other board level security experts believe the CEO is the biggest barrier to improving cybersecurity. And that maybe puts too fine a point on it, but I think holistically, the same thing you talk about, Jason, it's if you're not given the authority, if you're not given, you know, access to the board, if you're not given the right budget, or you're not allowed to manage, you know, security, like that does all roll up to the CEO. And I think, you know, in those organizations where the structure is that the CISO reports to the CIO or he's down level, like, again, that's the perspective of the CEO. And that's something that people really need to evaluate when they're looking at these roles and how security is structured, and boards should look at, like, they should be asking those questions of the CEO. How are they addressing that risk, that cyber risk in their environment? And I think the answers they give are really sometimes telling about, you know, where they really see the alignment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, on the budget side, you know, I used to talk about this in presentations when I was out doing presentations, like how much are you spending on like antivirus and older mm-hmm. technologies that you have these maintenance? Are you investing security controls in cloud and applications and identity and the things that are transforming, like, right? And so I think a lot of it from a budget perspective is making sure you're spending on the right stuff, because there are new areas that have to be accounted for. And it may not be you need to spend more overall, you need to shift budgets. Because as I go through, because I'm going through our budgeting process now, not from a security perspective, but I have to re-educate my president and my CEO on why I'm making decisions around budgets based on my revenue plans to drive the business, right? If you build a financial model that shows the costs associated to drive the revenues, then you don't get into this tit for tat, like, well, you can't spend money there. Well, if I can't spend the money there, then I can't drive the business here. So which one do you want to get rid of? See, we got to think like that as CISOs too.
Yeah, 100%. And the other side too is, go ahead, Ben.
No, I was just saying you have to start with the justification for it, right? I mean, if you start with, I need X versus, hey, if we want to be successful in this business direction, here's the investment that we need to do that, right? And if they don't want to make the investment, okay, then you're telling me that we don't want to be successful in this area. I mean, it's the justification that's really important, not the underlying spend. Although, I mean, there is balance there, but I think if you miss the justification piece of it, you'll never get the allocation.
Yeah, right, right. And ultimately, this is where it's going to benefit security leaders to speak the language of the business, right? Because when I'm going after funds or investment, I'm going to do the diligence around it, and I'm going to start having conversations around EBITDA and how I can either help drive revenue or create operational efficiencies, right?
Yep.
Here's a good way to get something to happen. Maybe, you know, for larger organizations who have subsidiaries and you're a parent company and you have all these different businesses that fall under your organization, go look for economies of scale. Maybe you have 5 different EDRs out there. If you consolidated them, you could maybe save some money, right? Look at third-party vendors that you're using. You may have, you know, one SIM SOC vendor here and one SOC vendor there and a separate SIM there. Consolidate. Get operational efficiencies. Start helping drive that the profitability of the organization, right? These are the conversations you need to be having. Now you're showing value back to the business from a business perspective, from a financial perspective. They're looking at you as someone who takes the finances of the organization very seriously, and you're looking at ways to save money so you can invest better.
Back to understanding the business, right? Because if you understand the business and how the business works and operates, and you understand key initiatives for the upcoming year, now you can align yourself to those and either show, you know, a faster way to market to drive that revenue, a cost saving by consolidating and streamlining things. That requires you to understand the business.
That's why it's so important to have the seat at the table, right? I mean, so many CISOs that, you know, I hear, well, you know, it's okay that I'm not there. I'm worried about the security. Yeah, but if you don't understand the strategic initiatives of the business, you don't understand how to align yourself and make those plays that Jason was talking about to, you know, hit the underlying, the EBITDA or, you know, the strategic initiatives that the company's trying to address. I mean, that's why you have to be part of those discussions.
I'll tell you, if you're a CISO right now and you don't have a copy of the business plan or the strategic plan for 2022, get on it. If you don't know, now you know. Go get a copy of the strategic plan for the organization so you can start aligning to those high-level goals that the business has. You know, they'll probably outline 4 or 5 top-level goals that they're trying to meet. Align your entire program to one of those or all of them.
Yes, and it changes the budget discussion, right, Jason? It changes your 100%. Discussion about how you're getting funded if you can align with those things.
That's it.
Exactly. While you're at it, can you go grab your travel security program? Do you have one? Like, I was reading this article and I was thinking, like, this is really interesting information. I just wonder how many people actually have a travel security program. And in over the last 2 years, maybe you didn't need one, but I'm curious. Do either
of you have? Time to dust it off. I mean, you know, I've been embedded in IT services for a very long time now, and travel is just nature. It's part of the business. I mean, everybody traveled overseas and internationally, you know, nationally. So having those best practices when it comes to employees who are traveling, it's just been ingrained in everything I've done for well over a decade at this point. So yeah, something I've definitely had in our best practices, no doubt.
Well, I remember
Go ahead, Matt.
I was going to say real quick, I remember when I was traveling for RSA, and I remember going to Turkey with Art Coviello and the security requirements we had when we went there. And then we went to Abu Dhabi and, you know, different risk profile, different set of requirements, right? And I kind of forgot about those days because I just don't travel enough internationally anymore.
Like, seems so long
understanding ago. Country risks and stuff, like, things have had to have shifted over the past few years too. So like, you got to dust it off and kind of refresh.
Yeah, 100%. And honestly, you should be, especially if you're doing things like geo-blocking, you should be understanding the, you know, the countries of risk every year and doing some level of a of a review every year. I mean, I know that's something that I've done. And, you know, with geo-blocking, you would have protocol and procedure for employees who are traveling to high-risk countries, right? And we'd go through our process and procedures to make sure they could go do work, but they were still safe.
Yeah. And again, why it's key to understand the initiatives of the business. If you're planning to start up operations in China, you better understand the difference.
You better know. Business in China.
Right. And don't be surprised by it. We've been sending executives there for 6 months. That's something I think you got to be on top of.
Right. Last article. I pulled this out for you, Jason. This is a great article. Sunil Yu wrote an article about, is cybersecurity a profession or a vocation? And he makes some great points in this article, and I wanted to cover it because, you know, we've tracked Sunil for his cyber defense matrix, and Adrian's done a lot of work with him, et cetera. But he makes a very good point in that in other industries, whether it's military, healthcare, technicians, you have professionals and you have vocational jobs. And in cybersecurity, we think everything has to be a profession, but does it? Because other industries have vocations that don't require full degrees, medical assistants, LPNs, the list goes on and on and on, where you don't need full-blown degrees. And he's making a very valid point that should we think about certain jobs as vocational jobs, not as professional jobs? And will that help us fill the skills gap?
So here's the one thing I want to say coming out of this, right? And I love this article because you know this is a passion of mine. The one thing I would change is it's not an or, it's an and. Because it can be a vocational job and then become a professional job. The goal is, and I'm, you know, I've said this before on the show, I am the prime example of that high school student who had no idea what the hell they wanted to be when they were graduating high school. So we joined the military. Thank you, Lord above, for the ASVAB test. If it was not for the ASVAB test, I would have never known I had an aptitude for technology. Boom, done. How do we get that aptitude test as early as we possibly can? I was not built for college at 18 years old. I just wasn't. I was built for college when I was in my mid-20s, right? When I got out of the Marine Corps. Now I was ready for it. How do we take kids who are in high school, students in high school, get them to the point where we know they have an aptitude for technology and or cybersecurity, both, right? And get them on a path to get a job out of high school. Make them career ready after 12th grade. Then when they feel they're mature enough and they know where they want to focus and they want to go to school and actually invest money, they can if they want to. If not, they still have a career path and they can still become professionals through that career path. Mm-hmm. It's not an or, it's an and.
Yeah, yes. Jason, I'm glad you jumped into that because I wasn't really interested in where you would come out. I had a feeling, you know, this is a really hot button topic for me. And for those that don't know, I actually don't have a bachelor's degree, right? And so this is near and dear to my heart. And I think that there are a lot of people out there who have a lot of potential. And, you know, for whatever reason, we have focused on everybody needs to have a degree. Everybody needs to, from high school, go into, you know, college, graduate with a degree and go into debt. And, you know, for some of us, that just wasn't possible going into debt. And, you know, we had to figure out another way around it. And so, you know, from my own internal perspective, I think that I didn't like the article in terms of it said, you know, look, hey, you can be a technologist and be vocational and then another track is professional and that still requires a degree. I think a degree is just, it's one path, right, to get there. But ultimately, just because you don't have a degree doesn't mean that you can't succeed. And I think we need to look back for where security started. And there weren't degrees when I was going to college. There weren't degrees really for people who wanted to have a security career. You could certainly be, you know, go for programming or, you know, some other IT related track, but it's not something, you know, I started with a programming degree in college with a CS degree. Not something I would really use in the track that I'm in now. Like many other degrees, I might as well have gotten a business degree or, you know, a marketing degree. It wouldn't have mattered for where I am now. However, I think foundationally, it's just important to have a good foundation to develop skills and then, you know, keep progressing, keep learning along your track. Right. And I think, you know, there are things out there, there are degrees out there now for people who want to have a security track. And that is one path. But I've seen a lot of people over my career that didn't have degrees that I would hire in a heartbeat and are great professionals. And so I think that there's a need to get back to vocational training here, whether it's, you know, welding, plumbing, electrician, or, you know, technology related. It's an option and a path for a lot of people out there who don't want to go to college or, you know, can't fund college and, you know, learn on the job and put a lot of time and effort and you know, come out in a very positive end result.
Thank you for sharing your story, because again, it just shows how it's not, you know, like I said, it's not an or, it's an and, right? You can go into IT or cybersecurity as a vocation to begin with, and then mature the hell out of your career and become a professional and become a leader, right? And I think that's important for people to understand. And I always think about, how do we change the paradigm? Because the educational system's still stuck in the old ways. Our hiring practices are still stuck in the old ways. Our HR departments are stuck in the old ways. The only way I can see for us to shift this and really flip it on its ear is we as security professionals who are passionate about this need to get involved at every level we possibly can. I'm embedded with Rhode Island Department of Education. I have monthly meetings talking about computer science and career pathways. I'm meeting with superintendents around our state about CTE programs. You know, I'm part of Rhode Island College's board, where I, you know, an advisory board on cybersecurity. You know, it's embed yourself everywhere you can to influence, because we have to change this. We have to change the paradigm.
You know, I'm the opposite of Ben, right? I actually have 2 degrees and I don't use either one. Because because there wasn't a cybersecurity degree. Yeah. Cybersecurity, guys, remember, I 96, I start thinking about security and antivirus and firewalls. Like, I learned on the fly. So if you want to think about it from the purely opposite end, Ben, for a second, right? I had 2 degrees that I don't use, and I still had to learn from the grassroots all the way up through my career, because there was no place to get formal education on this. Now, it's better today than it ever has been, but it doesn't have to be the only path, because people have learned this over the past 25 plus years in a space that's continually evolving. And so you can learn it on the fly. You do not necessarily have to have a degree in this space.
And that's right. One of the challenges. Like, I think a lot of people rail against the fact that, you know, we see so many job descriptions where they ask for entry-level people, but there's associated experience required, right?
Yep.
And people rail against that. But the problem is, even if you went into a really good cyber program, after you get out in 4 years, the data you learned is 4 years old, right? And so there's this constant evolution and constant change in the industry that's going on, and it moves so fast. It's hard to say there's a programmatic way to learn this. Like, there's a good way to get a good foundation, but ultimately, at the end of the day, I like, when I'm looking for someone to fill an entry-level SOC role, somebody who's actually done some stuff and has some experience and can walk me through over the last 12 months how they've seen interesting things and how they've addressed them and their thought process to how they work through a problem, much more interesting to me than a cyber degree.
Oh, that's not to say it doesn't carry weight. There have been so many instances where I've had the opportunity to bring someone in from a university, and then it takes 6 to 8 months to get them up to speed with their feet under them. I've also had the opportunity to have interns who were in high school programs that I would have hired if they decided they wanted to go full time when they graduated, because you know, they were taking cybersecurity programs in high school. They were doing internships and learning on the job. You know, it's just different. And I would have hired that high school intern over, you know, a college graduate, just because I could put them to work right away without having to retrain them.
Yeah. Yep. Back to hands-on training and vocational education and internships, right? Yeah. Gentlemen, always a pleasure. Thank you for joining me today. Thank you, everyone, for joining us. We are going to be recording every week in 2022, including holiday weeks, which means we have a slightly modified schedule. That means we'll see you again on Friday on Business Security Weekly.